quantitative analysis of plasticity models. And if we are in this business, I mean in quantitative analysis of plasticity, or not only plasticity, for other models, then the general theme. We have our differential problem. We construct by this or other way, we construct a finite dimensional subspace, project our differential problem on this subspace, get some approximate solution, and then investigate the behavior of this approximate solution. And this is the general scheme. This VH always denotes the this finite dimensional subspace. H is a small parameter, and depending on whether or not this VH is contained in V, there are two classes, big classes of methods. They are called conforming and non-conforming methods. Another classification of methods of quantitative analysis is based on which type of these trial functions we use to construct finite dimensional subspace. If our functions are such that their support is approximately the same or comparable with omega, then we have global approximations. And for example, Ritz method is a typical global approximation method. And if we have trial functions which are locally supported, and the diameter of this set, of this supporting set, is much less than the diameter of omega, and moreover, it decreases systematically in the process of refinement, then we have locally based approximations. But for this group of methods and for this, there are three basic properties which we must take care of. First of all, this system of trial functions, this system of finite dimensional spaces should be limit dense. It should be in some sense regular. This is not this irregularity which we mean in the theory of partial differential equations. This is a different regularity. I cannot talk much about this and say only in a very general terms. It means that the meshes which are associated with these trial functions, they do not contain geometrical figures of certain type. For example, they must not contain geometrical figures with degenerating angles. It's one of the properties. And of course, this system of functions must be quasi-orthogonal, because then the corresponding finite dimensional problems will be well posed. There are four main questions which always arise in this quantitative analysis. The first one is to prove that this our projected solution converges to the exact one. The second one is to investigate this abridge this projected problem as it is, and to prove that it is also correct, and suggest some viable method for solving it. Then item three is that to establish a priori rate convergence estimates, which are asymptotic estimates in term of H. And the last item is to derive a posteriori estimate. So today I will give an overview, and I will try to combine, first of all, problems related to plasticity and these items. Of course, in some sense, this is a too ambitious task for two-hour lecture, but I will give you just an idea of how which methods are applied. So let's start with one. And to see how such type results are proved, we will consider this variational inequality, where A is a bilinear form, G is a certain convex continuous functional. Or for example, if we have a Bingham fluid, then this set K on which this variational inequality is defined, this set K will be just this space of solenoidal functions with H1 norms. A will be this guy defined by the velocity strain. So now we project this variational inequality into a finite dimensional subspace, and the KH, then here one more question arises, that in general we have we will have not K but KH, which somehow must be associated with this K in the original space. And here, to have successful approximations, we must implement several more requirements, which are anyway not that difficult to verify in practice. So this is quite natural, and this is a version of limit density, but in terms of sets. So for any V and any epsilon bigger than zero, there exists such H epsilon that if H is lesser than this H epsilon, then we will find VH such that it approximates V with the accuracy epsilon, and this VH is in this KH. So this is a version of limit density in terms of sets. And this weak compactness of the set K is also required. So in our particular method, we use conforming approximation. So VH is in V. This condition V may be not able to really satisfy, but instead we will apply this weaker form of this condition which we just discussed. And one more assumption which is necessary for proving these results is that this G is Lipschitz continuous. So the first theorem. Under these assumptions which we have made, the solution exists unique and tends to U in V in our space. Let's prove it. We take arbitrary element V of the set K, and then, in view of our density assumption which we just have made, we know that there will be, for any H, there will be an element VH in KH such that this VH will tend to V. So now we consider a sequence of expanding finite dimensional spaces which expands as H tends to zero. And due to that requirement, we know that this holds. And now we will insert this VH here as a trail function. The next step is to rewrite this inequality as this one, putting this VH here, and then estimate by obvious estimates the right-hand side. Indeed, here I apply Lipschitz continuity of G, and therefore I have this L. Here I estimate the norm of F, and here I refer to the ellipticity of the form A, so it is bounded, therefore I have this. Then, with the only one small item, this guy is bounded from below by C1 multiplied by squared norm of UH minus VH. Therefore, I will divide by C1 both parts, and I will have that one. And now we know that this VH, it tends to V. Therefore, this sequence is bounded. I can find some constant which is independent of H and put it as an upper bound. So this side is bounded. And this means that the difference of UH minus VH, which is bounded, is bounded. This means that UH is bounded. So we can extract weakly converging subsequence from this sequence. And since this J is convex and continuous, it is weakly lower semi-continuous. We have weak convergence. For us, it is enough to write this. This exactly is written due to this fact that this functional A is simply a quadratic functional, and this is a convex continuous functional. So this is, of course, this sum is a convex functional and continuous functional. And therefore, it is weakly lower semi-continuous, which exactly means what is written here, that for any weak sequence, if I substitute this weak sequence here and pass to Leibniz, then what I get will be bigger than the value of this functional computed on this weak limit. Other relations are obvious. Since VH tends strongly, then we have this limit. And this limit is also obvious, because here weak convergence is enough to pass to the limit. So now I take this, this, and this, and apply to this relation. So in this relation, now I will pass to limit. When I will do this, this right-hand side will be replaced by this, and here I can pass to limit having only weak convergence. So here you are. We have this relation from which, if we now rearrange it back, so I take that AWW, put it here, write the first term in this way, then also extract this GW from here. So you see that our weak limit satisfies the original variational inequality, which means that any weak limit constructed of a sequence of finite dimensional problems constructed in such a way will be exact solution of the original problem. This is the first and the weakest, I would say, result. It remains to prove that this is not only a weak limit, but it is also a strong limit. And to do this, we will take this form written as follows, and just formally represent it as these three guys. And here we note that that one which is blue can be estimated by the variational inequality. This is what is written here. This is variational inequality written in a bit special form. So now I take this and substitute here. And when I do this, then this guy, A, UH with the sign minus, goes here. So here, again, I have this complex A plus G. And on the right-hand side, I have what remains. So this is just, to my mind, this is just repeated for convenience. I repeat it, yes. Just repeat it on the next transparency. So what we have in the right-hand side? This tends weakly to U, and this tends strongly to V. And for this convex continuous functional, we have this limit. So it is the story about this one. So in the right-hand side, in the left-hand side, when we pass to limit, we have this relation. This limit plus this guy, which originated from this inequality, is lesser or equal, then here will be g of v, here it will be a u v, and all other things are direct. It remains to set here v equals u, which I always can do, because u also is an element from the admissible set. So when I put it here, then I have, then I see that this limit plus this guy plus the same guy in the right hand side plus a u u. I keep these zeros just to show that this zero comes from here, this zero comes from here, and this is here. So you see, you have zero. You see that this limit is zero, which means that we have strong convergence. So this is the method by which the most simple, the most primitive results concerning the fact that our sequence converges to the exact solution can be proved, and it is typical for many other problems. Some critics about this type result. Of course, here many things were based on the fact that we have used internal or conforming approximations. If it is the case, then indeed such type results can be obtained by rather general, rather direct methods. But if you operate with non-conforming approximations, it cannot be done in such a way. And then the problem even of simple convergence, it arises as a really complicated problem. And sometimes it simply may not be true unless we prove some stability results. Okay, now item two, about solvers. Here I want to show you an idea of how people construct successive approximations when they solve these finite dimensional problems. Because when you have a nonlinear equation, just imagine you retranslated your problem to a nonlinear system. It is a finite dimensional system, but anyway, it is a nonlinear system of very large dimensionality. And it may have hundreds of thousands of unknowns. So how to get solution of such type problem? There are several approaches. Of course, I cannot discuss all of them. I give you as a hint just one. And I also will discuss it on the paradigm of the problem which is related to plasticity, and not in the finite dimensional setting, but in the general setting. But you can easily retranslate it into the finite dimensional setting. So this is the model which we will discuss. We want to find solution of this nonlinear problem, which can be thought of as a problem of elastoplastic hardening media, stationary problem of elastoplastic hardening media, and this function gamma, which is here, depends on which type of hardening you have. You have linear hardening or power hardening or whatever. Different models can be studied within the framework of such type variational equality. And this is the form which comes from isotropic elasticity, and we know that that this norm is equivalent to the norm generated by epsilon, and I just remind you this decomposition, where from it follows that modulus of epsilon u squared will be just this squared term plus z1. And this is used later. So this is a technical reminder or technical estimates which show how in this concrete model the bilinear form, which is bounded from below and from above by the norm of by that norm generated by epsilon. So here you have this factor, and here you have, in this estimate, you have that one. So now what is the idea of the method? This is iteration, typical iteration solver, which can be used in many other nonlinear models. You replace your nonlinear problem by a sequence of linear problems, and you solve them in such a way. I set some initial guess about my unknown, about this UN. So we assume that this UN is known. On the very first step, it will be U0. And then this rho is some positive parameter, which is a method parameter. And then you solve, you find UN plus 1 by solving this linear problem. You see this term here, it acts as a linear functional. So actually what we have here, this linear functional, it can be called residual functional. If, for example, you managed on some iteration n, find un, which is our solution u, then this guy will be simply zero. If I substitute instead of un here u, then this guy will be zero. And then this iteration scheme stops and will produce the same u immediately. But of course, in reality, it can never happen. There is always an infinite sequence of functions constructed by such type methods, which at some time should be forcibly stopped. But how to guarantee that this method will generate something useful? And here again, fixed-point theorems can help, but other fixed-point theorems, classical for fixed-point theorems, which are Banach theorem, you must prove that you have a contractive mapping for such type algorithm. So you rewrite the problem in this abstract form, where T is some operator generated by this linear partial differential equations, and you must prove this. How to prove this? Okay, I will outline you and demonstrate on the paradigm of this problem how such type results are obtained. So we consider two predecessors and successors, U1, W1, U2, W2. And then I write this formula for W1, which comes out of U1. So it holds for any V here. And the same for W2, which is generated by U2. And then, as you can easily guess, I will select some V in some special way in order to combine these two relations and obtain something useful. And first of all, I subtract one from another, these two relations, and then I have the difference where this V is still kept as a free function, as a trial function. And on the next step, I set it as W1 minus W2. And then you have this relation. Now this V is replaced by the difference, so you have these three terms, where now, for us, most interesting are these two, which are linear, and we will represent them in a bit different form. Yeah, this is the energy norm. This is how it is related. This is a reminder because we will have contraction in terms of this one, but it will mean the contraction in terms of that norm also. And here, this formula, which we will use now, that divergence of divergence is actually can be represented in this form. This is a trace of our tensor, and here I take unit tensor converted with the epsilon, which gives me this divergence. So I use this fact here and represent this relation in this form. You see, this I came out from that formula. So, this k0 minus rho appeared because k0 has, we have it here in this form, and here we have rho. So when I rewrite this form, then I will have this one. This is from linear part, and this is nonlinear term. And now it is written in a unified form, so there is some tensor which is scalarly multiplied by this tensor of the difference. And now we recall that this tensor can be split in two parts, in deviatoric and this one, and spherical part, which are orthogonal. So when I will multiply this guy by this thing, when I will multiply, for example, by this term, then this deviatoric part vanishes. And here, vice versa, this part vanishes. So when I, and here this part is also purely deviatorical, because these are constants, and this is deviator, and this is deviator. So when I formally do this multiplication, the right-hand side will have this form. And now, I try to extract, to rewrite, to reshape this integral in such a way that to extract the same bilinear form, but with the power 1/2, as the bilinear form which is in the left-hand side of my inequality. So when, for this purpose, look what I'm doing. Here, this k0 in 1/2, one is associated here, but another is taken here. And here I have 1 divided by n, which is compensated by this unit tensor converted with this unit tensor, which gives me n. So this is just a formal manipulation which is identical. And the same thing here, I extract 2 mu in 1/2, and here 2 mu 1/2 to have here component of the bilinear form of the W1 minus W2. So here formulas are too long, so this part related to nonlinear terms, which were with gamma, they are just mentioned as three dots. I don't know how this is obvious for you, but here there are nothing but formal manipulations, and you see this norm is actually already extracted here. You see this thing. So now we apply something like Hölder inequality and rewrite the whole lot as this inequality. This is something which we will analyze later, and this is the precursor of the norm, which of the bilinear form which we will need. So this is what we finally obtain. We obtain this expression which contains only u, and here we have our bilinear form, but in 1/2, and this 1/2 comes out from this 1/2. Please look here. So now we remember that on the left-hand side, there is exactly the same guy as there, but in the power 1. So when we reduce 1/2, we have a in the power 1/2 is less or equal than this expression. And now it remains to study this expression and to subject to extract from here this contraction. So now the formula is written in a transparent form. So you see that here we have this factor, 1 minus rho squared, and here you have the difference between two predecessors of W1 and W2. And then we have another part associated with the deviatoric, and it has three terms. This one, which comes from linear component, and these two, which comes out from nonlinear components. And the idea is as follows. Now we must study properties of our nonlinearity, and we will need an estimate of this blue guy from above and estimate of this brown guy from below in order to have a totally estimate from above. And then we will try to manipulate with this factor rho in such a way that to get total factor lesser than 1. If this will be possible, then we have succeeded and we have a contracting mapping. So it is clear that the success and the extent of the success crucially depends on properties of this nonlinear mapping. So in one case it is simple, in another case it may be very difficult. But actually if we operate with such type problems in nonlinear elasticity or plasticity, as you wish, we need these two estimates, which, for example, I have no time, and this is a rather technical subject, but I can tell you that, for example, for such models as plasticity with linear hardening or plasticity with power hardening, with logarithmic part hardening, such type estimates can be proved fairly easily. And these constants can be C and delta, they can be found. So now we will assume that we have these estimates. Again, this is a purely algebraic matter, because gamma is the algebraic function which depends on modulus of tensor, so it is a matter of some algebraic exercises, how to get them. And now, what we... Sorry. Now we apply one here and one here, and then we... And then you see that we have this. So this guy stands as it is. Here we replaced by lower bound, and you see this delta appeared. And the blue we measured by that one. So finally what we have 1 minus rho squared, and this is this part, and here we have this factor. But look, if I take this K0 and I append this to mu here, then we will have a real bilinear form. Because bilinear form, they say, it has this factor here and it has factor 2 mu here. So everything depends on these two brackets. If both these brackets are positive and lesser than 1, then we are done. And by how we can achieve this? By selecting rho. So these are two conditions for this rho. And these conditions are written here. One is obvious, rho must be in the interval 0, 1. But another one is just... it is written that this thing should be positive in order to, it should be some small positive number in order to have here factor lesser than 1. And it gives you this. So in this case you have a contraction with the factor Q here, where it is computed explicitly, and then you may enjoy all advances of Banach contracting mapping theorems, which gives you all estimates a priori, a posteriori, and everything and you can fully control what you are doing. Of course, here you only must have in mind that even if all this which we discussed is applied not to infinite dimensional problems but to finite dimensional problems, in this analysis there is no difference. It doesn't matter. But all what is said will be correct provided that all other computations are done exactly. So you compute your integrals exactly. There are other sources of difficulties here. And if you solve linear systems, because if you let's return at the very beginning to this setting. So here, if I mean by U and V finite dimensional solutions, then this problem is a problem associated with some system of linear simultaneous equations. So if you are sure, if you're sure that you can solve this system exactly, then, but if not, the analysis is more complicated. So this is item 2. Now about a priori rate convergence estimates. Again, my task is rather difficult because I want to discuss a priori rate convergence estimates for perfect plasticity. But it is a bit unnatural to discuss rate convergence estimates for one of the most complicated elliptic problems without no experience in this method for standard elliptic problems. Therefore, I need to make some very, very short introduction in the subject, because otherwise you will simply do not understand what is the difference. And the standard a priori rate convergence theory is based on two keystones. And these keystones are projection type estimates and interpolation theory for functions in Sobolev spaces. So projection type estimates, they can be derived for linear elliptic problems, they can be derived very easily. For example, for linear elliptic problems which are associated with quadratic type functionals, so you have bilinear form and you have this functional I, which is this bilinear form minus linear functional. So then for such type problems, you can easily prove this equality, that the difference between U and any function which you compare with U is exactly the same as the difference between functional computed on this function and the minimal value, the value on the minimizer. This is a very general estimate which holds for all problems with quadratic functionals. And if you have this, and UH is the minimizer of the finite dimensional problem. So UH is lesser than E of UH is lesser than E of VH. Then you have this. And then you apply the same identity again and you have this. And then you reduce factor 1/2 and then you have this. Which means that the error computed in terms of the bilinear form is just equal is the minimizing the all admissible errors among all VH in this admissible space. So this is the simplest, the primitive form of the projection type error estimate. Then, when you have this estimate, the second step is related to interpolation theory in Sobolev spaces. And this interpolation theory is focused on estimates in different Sobolev norms between functions, between Sobolev functions, and their so-called interpolants. So they are projectors on the space of polynomial functions, or piecewise polynomial functions. And the typical estimate, which is as a kernel of this theory, this one, that if I have V and this pH is the projector on the space of polynomials of the degree t, and m is the power of my t is the integration power, and m is the polynomial degree. So I have this estimate, which you see depends on the norm, which is higher that there is some misprint here. It should be t plus 1 there. The norm should be high. I'm sorry, there is a misprint. So the this error computed in some norm is estimated by higher norm of this V. And it depends on this factor, where h and rho, h is the size of the simplex. So your domain here, this one on which you write this estimate, is simplex. So h is the size of this simplex, and rho is the radius of the inscribed ball. The presence of this term dictates these words about regularity, which I said at the beginning, because of course if you diminish your the size of your simplexes th, this factor should remain bounded. Otherwise, these estimates, they lose accuracy, they lose their sense. And from here, this angle condition comes out. But these are details, which may be not that interesting now. So combining these two facts, this projection estimate and interpolation estimate, it is easy to derive standard asymptotic convergence estimates. Just we in the projection estimate, we substitute here interpolant. And since this difference between u and phu can be estimated from above, then we immediately have estimates like this. So here we have that one, and due to interpolation theory, we have this estimate, and here you are. So if to summarize what I have said, exact solutions, what we need to get such type a priori estimates. We need in the, for second order elliptic problems, we need extra regularity, H2. Then we need to know that our UH is indeed Galerkin approximation, so it is exact solution of the finite dimensional problem. And we need to have this non-degeneration condition. Now, how to obtain such type estimates for Henke plasticity, for example, for one of the most complicated models in the theory of non-linear elliptic problems. Of course, we have no hope to get such type estimates being based on the primal formulation, because as we discussed on one of previous lectures, the primal original formulation, the formulation in terms of displacements, it is incorrect. And if we make a variational extension of this problem and redefine it in this space BV or BD, then this is a non-reflexive and non-separable space, and no results of regularity even in terms of H1 spaces can be proved. So there is no fundament on which we can try to construct this building. So it remains that the only one outcome, if we want to do something, is to consider this Haar-Karman principle, to study this variational functional, which is quadratic, but which is this star is missed there. So it is this one, but which is defined on a very unpleasant set. So I just remind you that if we now are talking about Henke model, and this set K comes from von Mises' law, this is the requirement of the tau is equilibrated stress. These are standard assumptions on external data, and moreover, we must assume that these F are such that the safe load condition holds. We discussed this matter already. So if we look at this problem, we must minimize that quadratic functional on this set, where this K is the ball, and this is this plane is somehow a model of this set Q of equilibrated stresses. I want to outline that we cannot reduce the verification of the fact that some element belongs to this set to a consequent verification of two facts, that it belongs to K and it belongs to QL, because this picture shows that if you project your function on the set K and then project it to the set QL, then the result may be not in this set. So double projection cannot help in this case. But even more, this set is defined in terms of pointwise condition. And this set is defined in terms of the integral relation, some integral identity. So these, strictly speaking, they lie in different functional spaces. So this is a very, very unpleasant problem. This is about problem V. Maybe I will just remind and go up to the point from which it will be convenient to continue. So this is what we discussed. This is the primal problem for Henke, which is if we want to pose it, we must also implement this limit load condition, but in a bit different form. We must write like this, and the result is that summary that both problems P and P star are difficult for quantitative analysis. That the primal problem is simply we do not know what to do, because it is defined in that abstract form that no approximations really can be studied, and this one is associated with this unpleasant set, which means three differentiable equilibrium equations plus this pointwise restriction should be simultaneously satisfied, and they should be satisfied exactly. What to do? How to overcome? The answer which I would like to discuss later is that to deal with this very complicated problem, you must use positive sides of both problems of primal and dual, and then we may hope for a success. Short break.